Since you're most famous for a book exploring a master having sex with a slave, mm-hmm. We had to have a segue somewhere. Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson. Uh-huh. I actually have two questions from one of my graduate students who desperately wanted to be here but could not. Mm-hmm. And Ms. Alice McShane, who's actually working on a dissertation on the idea of the slave power and actually testing it with the actions of some Southern senators in the 1850s. Uh-huh. She has given me a couple of questions that she said, oh, if you have a chance, work them in. And
okay.
I'm going to work them in. Now, they have really long lead-ups, and so I apologize for that. But so she starts with Genovese, and both the questions are really going to pull off Genovese.
Okay.
Genovese argues in Roll, Jordan, Roll that because both the master and the slave recognize that because of the slave's humanity, it's impossible to make the slave a thing, to make him or her a chattel. Masters implemented a system of paternalism. The slaves kind of accepted it, but interpreted it differently from the masters. The master saw it a system of duties and balances, mm-hmm. and the slave, it was a system of some rights within an unjust order. For the slave, the practical question facing slaves was not whether slavery was property, but how to survive in it, Genovese says, with the greatest degree of self-determination. So do you agree with Genovese's view of this master-slave relationship? And if so, then we have the question about Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson.
Okay. Do you agree with Genovese's understanding of how they tried to do this? Generally, I do. I think certainly the part about, there's certainly two different views about what this relationship is about, with blacks accepting, and slave people accepting the notion that this was an unjust system, that they did have some rights within it, and sort of trying to exercise those rights. And with whites acting the role of paternalists, trying to fit themselves in the most favorable light that they could, granting those rights on occasion.
Okay. Given black self-determination, then Alice asks, is this part of your picture of Sally Hemings' motivation for her possible involvement with Thomas Jefferson?
Well, that question has been asked a number of times without the long lead-up. certainly the story that Madison Hemings tells about how the relationship played itself out in France and how his mother decided to come back to France suggests some self-determination on Sally Hemings's part, because slaves were petitioning for freedom in France, and those petitions were regularly granted. She could have stayed there, but with the thought that her children would be okay, namely that they would be freed when they were grown, I think that there's a possibility that was her chief motivation. People ask me, well, why did she stay there? You know, why didn't she stay there? Who would come back with him on a promise like that? And, well, you know, somebody who's 17 years old, 16 or 17, can easily be, I think, influenced in that way. But certainly the idea of doing something for her children, getting an assurance, a promise about her children, is an example of self-determination on her part, when she could have done something else, because she really could have stayed there. Yeah.
Do you think that Sally's family's history, that her sister had a relationship with Thomas Bell, could have influenced, and didn't her mother also have a relationship with a master? And could Sally have had a more beneficent view of things from that kind of history?
Well, I think that that's possibly true. I think that's likely true. One of the things that I'm working on a book now about the Hemings family, and one of the things that I have to confront and to think about is how different racial sensibilities would have been, to try to figure out just who they think they are within this relationship, because they're not like other enslaved people on the mountain. They are treated differently. They have a familial connection to Jefferson, not just Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson, but Jefferson's wife and Sally Hemings were half-sisters. And from that, and they were treated differently. Jefferson, her brothers, had pretty much free movement. What would it be like to be a person, an enslaved person, and to have your family treated that way? To be an enslaved person who's more English than African. We have a very well-developed sense of racial solidarity today, but that wouldn't have been present necessarily at that time. They would have been very, very sharp senses of difference and hierarchy at that time. I think she might, we can't say, who's to say that she didn't think that a liaison, a connection to a white person, was certainly better in terms of the prospects for her children than being with someone who was, as they say, down the mountain. Because she nor any of her sisters married anybody down the mountain. All their liaisons were with white men or with other house servants of similar genetic background. So there's something going on here that's very different that I don't think people have investigated or thought seriously enough about, or written enough about.
And it's interesting because there's this, you know, the great fear of miscegenation that runs through much of Southern history has peaks and valleys of tremendous interest.
Mm-hmm.
And Virginia, of course, in the early 20th century is struck with a tremendous miscegenation fear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whites in control of Virginia pushed through the most rigid anti-miscegenation law in the American experience, the Virginia Racial Integrity Act of 1924.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the only one-drop rule,
mm-hmm,
basically out there, and it sounds like you're pushing back to this kind of, how do we understand how people defined race in different times?
Yes, because
and not just as pseudoscientists, but real
people.
But real
people. What did they think of themselves as? And you can get a sense of it to some degree by how they acted in slavery, and certainly afterwards when, you know, you one of the things that they're doing now at Monticello is a project called Getting Word, and they're interviewing people who are descendants of not just Hemingses, but other people who were enslaved at Monticello. But one of the things that's turning up in the Hemings family interviews is this really, really sharp sense of themselves as not white, not black, as a separate caste of people who marry within that caste, who are very, very, very strong about that, is seeing themselves as not white, not black, marrying people on the basis of skin color and so forth to keep it within those lines. So this is something that evidently starts in slavery and continues, you know, well into the 20th century among people. And it's a sense of racial solidarity, a different sense of racial sensibility that has been sort of obscured in the sort of black-white dichotomy.
Yeah.
The way we see things.
I mean, even somebody like the black lawyer Pauli Murray talks,
mm-hmm,
about her family and the range of colors.
Oh yeah.
The tremendous range of colors but also her aunt's determination to be race women,
mm-hmm,
to celebrate the race, to call themselves black or,
mm-hmm,
Negro with a capital N,
mm-hmm,
so people know who they are, and it's very interesting because in some ways to me that always seemed that they're doing that in rejection of the badge of inferiority that the segregation laws are now trying to impose on people.
Absolutely, and as far as the Hemings is, in all fairness to them, certainly when this gets going in slavery, you understand the reason for it, because Sally Hemings' children can move to Washington and marry into, you know, prosperous white families and leave all of that behind them because of because they have married people who are fair skinned or white skinned or had children with white people. It's a matter of literally of life and death, the difference between the kind of degradation that you could suffer in slavery and then the sort of, you know, or as a black person living in America at that time, versus being a white person and being able to live your life with dignity.
And
lots
have
at stake.
There's a property value. There's a real property and personal value in whiteness.
Exactly. And so, you know, as I said, today we have, because of the way things worked out, people who were mulattoes, people who were mixed race, were shunted over into blackness. We didn't have the kind of gradation. So we're used to thinking of people you know, who are tremendously fair-skinned, who could, for all intents and purposes, could be white, will say that they're black. And now, or and sometimes people who criticize individuals who pass because it's sort of a social choice. But back in those days, I mean, it was a social choice, but it was a social choice that had tremendous, tremendous meaning for people.
And the people who got to choose who you once you have a system of segregation by law, the people who got to choose your color, you could assert your color, whether you were black or white, as the law pulled it. Mm-hmm. But train conductors and people who ran public accommodations really got to be the ones who told you.
Yeah, exactly.
And in Barbara Welke's book, Recasting American Liberty, some mm-hmm. of, I think, her best stuff is these white people who are cast as black uh-huh. and how they react. Does it ring a bell with
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah. It mirrors a lot of studies when they ask people, you know, what would it, I think it was Andrew Hacker who asked white students, how much money would it take for them to be considered black? You know, how much, what would be the payment for that? And it was just, you know, in the millions and millions and millions of dollars. Because even there, just in a sort of unsophisticated, instinctive reaction, they understand that you lose something when you're considered black.
Well, these white people who are put into the smoker car or put into the
oh, yeah.
black car, I mean, they sue and they win big amounts.
Of money.
And more importantly, the railroads know they're in trouble and they want to settle as fast as possible. They're as bad as an injury case. They're running there with the checkbook as soon as possible. Something they will never do for most black plaintiffs.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge loss. I mean, when a couple of years ago when they did a Frontline documentary about the Hemingses, and there was a member of the Hemings family who I guess his family, they've always lived as white people, but he was so disconcerted about the idea that people would know that Sally Hemings was one of his ancestors that when he appeared on screen, there was sort of a gray dot over his face. And you think about this. This is seven generations ago that a woman who is a quarter black was your progenitor. And he believes that right now, if people knew that, you know, eight generations ago, this quarter African person was his great-grandmother, that he would be black and he would lose something. And that's why he was ashamed to appear without his face obstructed.
It's the same reaction as the racial integrities and the segregation laws are coming down, and you have mixed, Smith talks about in his book, you have these mixed-race people, Indian, white, black, who are suddenly really asserting their Indian ancestry
exactly.
a lot more.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, having spent time in Virginia, everybody always married into an Indian princess. No one was ever a normal Indian.
Well, that's exactly. Well, it's the same thing. You know, you go back to Egypt. You were always, you know, Cleopatra. Nobody was ever, you know, a peasant pushing a rock up the pyramid.
You know, I want to go back to a point we were talking about before. We were talking about a range of color in the peoples of America. And it's not just Africans and whites bringing race into America, but very importantly, as you get into the late 19th and 20th century, other groups, Asians, and other people, are categorized under the racial theories as they begin to emerge, and they're, you know, there's an attempt to kind of shove them into that bipolar black white world.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really interesting. You can see how much a penalty black is by how hard the other people struggle not to
try not to be put into that category.
And in many ways, they use the racist theory against those who would push them there. Mm-hmm. I think the classic case is the Arminians who in California, they want to use restrictive covenants against them, saying they're not members of the white race. And they bring in anthropologists to say, Arminians are from the Caucasus.
And so they're Caucasian.
Yes.
Not long ago, several months ago, there was a front page article in the Los Angeles Times investigating this phenomenon of immigrants who come to the country saying that they're white, no matter where they're from, Africa, Asia, or whatever. And they ask them, why do you put down that you're white? And they say that white is American, that being white is you know, the sort of, that's the standard of what an American is. And so these people who, by American standards, if people saw them and looked at them and saw their background, would never say that they were white in some ways, but these are people who are claiming whiteness because of the value that it gives them. And they understand that. People all over the world understand that.
Even though Madison Avenue tries to broadcast, you know, America in the colors of Bennington, it hasn't taken.
No, it hasn't. It apparently has not taken for people who are coming in as immigrants. They understand that they get a benefit by being considered white as opposed to other.
Now, in your new book, Race on Trial, you're doing the scope of American history. You go back to all the way to the colonial period, if I read the cases right.
There's something, yes.
And all the way up to, like, 5 years ago.
We got O.J.
What was the impetus behind this book? How did you see this book developing?
Well, to talk about the way race and law intersect, that we thought that trials are a good way of telling various aspects of the American story and how they change over time. You know, Jack Johnson versus O.J. Simpson, how are racial attitudes before? At one time, Jack Johnson, who is going out with white women, is a threat. O.J. Simpson, as long as he's not killing them or supposedly killing them, going out with white women is seen as a way of his accepting the norm in society. But it's all, in some ways, race is just below the surface. And so the idea was to show that across time how race has played itself out, not just with respect to black people, but we do have Korematsu of how Asians have been treated and how it's always just below the surface, things that are not ostensibly about race. I mean, obviously some of these are, but the racial attitudes in America are always there, no matter what.
How about some of the allies of people who are feeling racial oppression in some of the cases you deal with? I mean, I know the book deals with Scottsboro, and in part Scottsboro gets tied up with radicalism in America. There are very few people in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s willing to come and be their allies.
No, besides communists.
Yeah, besides communists.
People who are radicals. Because it's a radical idea, and those are certainly the only people who are outside of the society in some way can feel that they have the freedom to do that. They have nothing to lose. One of the things my father always used to tell me growing up, he said, you know, that one of the things about race is that there are lots of people who are of goodwill. In their hearts, they know better, but they don't feel free to act on those things because they feel that they will lose their community. They'll be penalized. So it's sort of a natural fit for communists or people who are on the left or who are outsiders to be the ones who champion black causes. Now, it causes a problem because it's a vicious cycle, because folks say, see, it's those un-American people, those people who are against America, who are for the blacks. And so we've always said that these people are our enemies, and here this proves it. So it's a no-win situation. They were the only ones, by and large, who would stand up when it was really, you know, the situation was at its most dire. But that in itself sowed the seeds for further distrust of black people.
In the earlier period, white abolitionists, some of them, were not afraid to associate with free blacks, did not see it as a particularly stigmatizing. Would they be an analog to the communists of the later era?
Well, they've certainly been used that way. Abolitionist is almost like an epithet now. I mean, you would think that people who were admittedly, some of them over the top in their pursuit of their aims would be seen as heroes. But they are portrayed very often as along the same lines, that same sense of distrust. They really are against our system in some way, but forgetting that the system that they were against was the system of slavery. Yeah. But they're certainly, different in the sense that there were quite some respectable people who were abolitionists in a way that you don't have prominent members of the Communist Party. But in terms of the sensibility of the way people portrayed them as the outsiders, as the ones who were the enemies, there's a parallel.
Yeah. I was actually thinking, as you were talking, I was thinking back to your book on Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, because when you were looking at people like Dumas Malone and Douglas Adair and some of the others in the way that they dismiss the oral history and they dismiss Madison Hemings especially, that these are also the same people who are at the same time dismissing abolitionists as hopeless fanatics.
Mm-hmm. Hopeless fanatics. And it's
psychologically warped.
Oh, yes. And one of them, I don't remember which one it was, but it was in some of the letters. Malone or Peterson refers to Fawn Brody as an abolitionist. You know, Fawn Brody lived in the 20th century, obviously, and, you know, this was well after that. But that, I thought it was very, very revealing in their understanding of the way they characterized people who were presenting an idea that they just couldn't accept. She's an abolitionist.
In many ways, the historians in that debate would have a lot of argument about character, Thomas Jefferson's character, and they would offer what in a criminal defense is probably one of the weakest things, the character defense.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, I know he would never do a thing like that, which nobody accepts in any other context, apparently, other than this one, as a serious kind of argument, because people immediately can see through the problem with that. Certainly people, you know, just a man that none of them have ever met, you know, never laid eyes on, that they would know how he would respond in all situations.
And as you say in the book, I mean, their reputations were on the line with this because they were the anointed experts. They really felt threatened because they thought they knew Jefferson.
Uh-huh. Oh, because that's the thing that certainly you're right, the thread that runs through this is that if we didn't know this, this is a pretty big deal. It's not a small thing, but you supposedly have told the life of a man, and then you find out that living in his household is a woman with whom he's had 6 children, and that would pose all kinds of problems, all kinds of issues about the nature of his relationship with his other family. This is not a trivial thing, so it really means that you would have to go back to the drawing board and come up with a new vision of who he was. It's not just something that could be tacked on. This goes to the heart of who he really was.
Have the revisionists started to get at you yet? Has anyone come to you with a question saying, oh, you were researching and writing this book, well, the disclosures about William Jefferson Clinton were coming on, and this is in the back of your mind. Has this happened to you yet?
I think because of the Nature article, when they wrote the Nature article talking about the DNA, I think Joe Ellis said that, well, these revelations should help Clinton and the Lewinsky thing, which if I had written that article, that would never have appeared. People have wondered about that, thinking that that this was my motivation, but no, that was, and then I have to tell them, no, this is not my motivation. I mean, I was working on this before I was thinking anything at all about Bill Clinton and not making any kind of, I would not use this book in service of that, certainly.
Well, it's the perils of easy historiography. It's one of the great fallacies. Oh, that was in the era, then it must have driven the book.
Oh, yeah, but people have raised that, and it's just, to me, astonishing, you know, to think that would have been my interest in any way, or that it does. I mean, there was a man and it was a woman, and there's sex that's involved in it, but there's so many. I mean, this is the 18th century and a totally different context. And no, but you're right, people have raised it.
Thank you very much, then.
You're very welcome.